Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, I'm Freddie Sayers, and this is Unheard. Back in March, everyone's world suddenly changed.
From this evening, I must give the British people a very simple instruction. You must stay at home.
So on day one of lockdown, we launched Lockdown TV, a place where we could gather experts, scientists, writers, politicians, thinkers, to try to help us understand what was going on in this strange moment and what kind of world we were going to get at the end of it. And now, due to popular demand, here we are in podcast form. Welcome to Lockdown TV.
So what is the real origin of COVID-19? Did it, as some people say, start in a lab? Was it an accident? Or was it a naturally occurring virus? Why does it even matter? You might think that after everything that's happened, it's not an important question. Well, I think it does matter because, first of all, we want to make sure it doesn't happen again, and it would help to know how it started to do that. It's claimed a lot of lives and it's turned the world upside down, so we should know just for posterity. But perhaps most importantly, the conversation around it, the idea that some ideas became taboo, the scientific community closing ranks around certain theories over others, has actually been quite symptomatic of a dangerous turn in the conversation in the last year. So I think it's really important to try and uncover it. Happily, we have someone called Nicholas Wade joining us now to help us do just that.
So if you step out of line and if you say, well, I think this virus may have escaped from the lab, you know, good luck on getting your grant renewed.
A science writer of many years at the New York Times for 30 years, I believe, and have recently published a very long technical article, pretty much going through all of the evidence we have for the different theories as to how COVID-19 originated. Hi, Nicholas.
Hi.
To begin with, what are the two main theories as regards COVID-19 origin story?
Well, one theory is that it jumped naturally from an animal host to humans, something that happens quite a lot. The other theory is that it escaped from a virology lab in Wuhan, where they were working on just this kind of virus, that it probably infected some of the co-workers and from there got out into the population at large. Those are the two principal theories.
And at least until now, where there seems to be a little bit of a change in the tone around this topic, the sort of conventional consensus view has been the first of those, right? That it was a naturally occurring and jumped from an animal to human.
That's right. And that's partly because the idea is very plausible. We have already had two recent epidemics originating from bat viruses, the SARS-1 epidemic of 2002 and the MERS epidemic a few years later. Plus, the structure of this virus makes clear it belongs to a family of bat viruses or was derived from them. So natural emergence is very plausible. And right from the start, the scientists who opined on this, several of whom had an interest in the issue, have assured us that this must be a natural occurrence, that lab escape was out of the question. And the media, by and large, didn't question this assumption as critically as they should have done. So what you say is exactly right. For the last 15 months, natural emergence has been the prevailing theory.
So you mentioned some of the scientists have other reasons for doing that. Let's just get into that before we get into the main evidence around the virus itself, because this really stood out to me from your piece. So that The man who actually organized the original letter to Lancet magazine, which is a very high status medical publication, who is also on the World Health Organization committee investigating the origins of the virus, actually was involved in procuring funding for virology research at Wuhan. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. His name is Peter Daszak, and he's president of the EcoHealth Alliance in New York, which specializes in monitoring viruses the world over. And the National Institutes of Health here in the US gave large grants to Dr. Daszak, which he in turn passed on to the Wuhan Institute of Virology.
And this wasn't talked about at the time, where he was just offering his expert opinion that that Wuhan Institute of Virology was not involved in the original COVID-19 problem.
Well, in the letter to the Lancet, which you mentioned, which he later turned out had been organized by Dr. Daszak, he, of course, had a considerable interest in the outcome, because if the virus had escaped from the Wuhan lab, which he had funded, he would be potentially to blame. But this conflict of interest was not declared in the Lancet letter, which moreover concluded, we declare no conflict of interest.
He's on the World Health Organization investigation committee, is that right? So it's not only that he's been arranging public statements that seek to dispel any doubt around the origins of the virus, he's actually doing the official investigation into it.
Yes, he has been a very central player all along. The WHO Commission, the membership was more or less controlled by the Chinese, which had sort of strong influence over the WHO and the conditions under which it would allow the commission into the country. And I think it's fair to say that, you know, all of the membership was acceptable to the Chinese, including Dr. Daszak.
Because that, I remember that well. They went and visited the lab, and then there was a press conference, and there was a declaration, what seemed to be quite immediate declaration, that the lab leak theory had been ruled out, as I recall. We actually published an investigation into that, an article by a prize-winning investigative journalist called Ian Birrell, and that was then censored on Facebook, saying that this article contains misinformation. And all it was doing was questioning the validity of some of those World Health Organization findings. So this spreads very far in terms of the willingness not to ask these kind of questions.
Well, that's right. Ian Birrell has been an outstanding reporter on this issue. Facebook's behavior has been quite amazing. It's almost as if you're under the control of the Chinese government, because my article as well, I don't know if that's still the case, but at least at one point, if you pulled it up, you were given a similar message. You were then directed to a sort of Chinese propaganda site. I was quite astounded that Facebook would behave in this way, and it sort of shows the severe limitations of its present system for addressing the content it carries.
Right, so let's get into the actual substance here, Nicholas. We will not, unlike those other people we talked about, try to rake over any coals or avoid any questions. Where do we start then? So the first theory, the one that has been the consensus theory, is this natural evolution theory, which basically entails that this was a virus found in the bat population, which would have leapt onto humans via an intermediary species. Is that pretty much it?
Yes, because it's all by analogy with the two previous epidemics. So in the case of SARS-1, the virus came from bats to animals called civets, which are sort of sold in Chinese wet markets, and from civets it jumped to people. In the case of MERS, the intermediary host was camels or dromedaries. So the natural assumption was that SARS-2 had reached the human population by this route.
So how did they know in those previous epidemics that that's what had happened?
Well, it's easy because the virus, when it makes this progression, leaves all kinds of telltale signs in the environment. I mean, first of all, there's the host population of bats, which you can find. Then there's an enormous trace left in the human serology. So hospitals have sort of surveillance records, and you can go back and test people have been exposed to. So in the case of SARS-1, which is sort of very indicative, I think, you see the virus sort of picking up one mutation after another as it adapted itself first to civets and then to humans. So at first it was a very sort of mild pathogen in humans, and then a few more mutations made it a stronger pathogen, and a few more, I think there's sort of 30 mutations altogether. By this time, it was a really strong pathogen. So you can track that retrospectively in the human population. With the case of SARS-2, what has become increasingly clear, and it's increasingly bizarre, is that there is no such trace of SARS-2 emerging in the natural environment in the same pattern as SARS-1. And that WHO commission that went to Beijing, as you mentioned, although it seemed at first sight propaganda victory for the Chinese, because they kept on saying a lab escape is ridiculous, we're hardly going to even consider it. What was also clear was that the Chinese had not been able to provide a shred of evidence in favor of the natural emergence hypothesis. So each month that goes by and you have no more evidence of natural emergence makes you have to consider the more strongly the lab escape hypothesis.
So in other words, if it was the normal natural emergence route as the previous epidemics, by now you would have expected either some trace in the virus itself or this intermediary species to have been identified, and so far it hasn't.
That's exactly true. So with SARS-1, I think we knew, we could see the trace in the natural environment after 3 months, and after MERS, it was after 7 months we found this evidence. So despite a presumably very intensive search by the Chinese, unless they knew better bother, we haven't found any of this to back up the natural emergence hypothesis for SARS-CoV-2.
Is there anything else on that side of the equation that we should cover off? I mean, is there any other evidence for the natural emergence hypothesis? If we got an expert here who believes in it, what will he or she say in its favor?
I think all that they can say is that it's a very plausible hypothesis. The whole idea rests on this single conjecture that it followed in the track of SARS-1 and MERS and the many other viruses that have jumped from animals. But what is clear is that there is no direct evidence for natural emergence. You know, I should quickly add, there's no direct evidence for lab escape either. But both these scenarios are plausible conjectures with no direct evidence supporting them. But you'd certainly expect a lot of it in the case of SARS-2, and we have no direct evidence yet for natural emergence.
So let's turn to potential scenario number two then, which is that the Wuhan Institute of Virology, which, as its name suggests, is situated right in the middle of Wuhan in China, where the first examples of COVID-19 were discovered, in some way synthesized this virus as part of an experiment. Is that the second theory?
Yes, it is, and it's more precise than that, because we know exactly what they were doing, at least in general outline, because they were funded by the National Institutes of Health via Peter Daszak, and there are abstracts available, not the full grant proposal itself, but at least an abstract of what their grant was going to do, publicly available, and you can tell that they were doing what virologists all around the world do. They were trying to, and this is perfectly legitimate research if one thinks it's worth it. They were trying to get a jump ahead of nature. They're trying to predict what couple of tweaks nature might need to make in an animal virus to make it a human pathogen. And to do that, they were trying to recapitulate these steps in the lab, which of course is highly dangerous. If in fact you succeed, then you've got a dangerous pathogen. And the way they were doing this, they were taking various coronaviruses. This is the family of viruses to which SARS-CoV-2 belongs. And they were inserting into a viral backbone the spike proteins that are that are what determines the host that the virus can attack. So they were inserting one spike protein after another, trying to increase the infectivity of the virus until they had something that would be a human pathogen. So they were well on the track by the design of their experiments to create, if not SARS-CoV-2 itself, something very like it.
So this is a technology and a process that you mentioned there's American scientists involved who first developed it and then seem to have taught the scientists at the Wuhan Institute how to do it, and they then continued it. Is that right? So it's almost an American-Chinese collaboration.
Yes, you could put it that way. I know, in a way, virologists sort of share all these techniques. They're a sort of international community of scientists, and they will share agents and knowledge and training with each other. So Dr. Zhengli Shi is the chief scientist at the Wuhan Institute of Virology.
She's referred to as Bat Lady at times.
She's well known in China for collecting these bat viruses, which she's been doing for 20 years or so. So it's not necessarily a pejorative term. It's just a sort of moniker she's acquired. So during the course of her work on these bat viruses, she went to work with Ralph Baric in North Carolina, who's the leading American expert on coronaviruses. And he had developed this technique of transferring spike proteins from one virus to another to make them more infective, you know, for the purpose of trying to predict future outbreaks, as I said. So she and Baric published a paper in 2015 in which they generated a novel virus. Scientists call this a chimera because it's a mixture of two genomes. They generated a chimeric virus that had the property of infecting humans. So there was lots of concern about this experiment at the time and discussion of whether this was the right way to go. Baric argued that, well, the benefits of doing this outweigh the risks and we should be allowed to go ahead.
They're actually creating a new virus in the lab and are seeing whether the virus infects human-like organisms. Is that what's happening in the lab?
Yes, that's correct. They're creating a novel virus that did not exist before in nature by combining the pieces of existing viruses together. And then, of course, you can't infect humans. That would be unethical. But they will test them either on cultures of human cells growing in the lab or on what they call humanized mice. So these are mice that have been genetically engineered so that the cells of their airways carry the very same protein called ACE2, which human cells carry and which is the target of SARS-CoV-2. So these viruses are trained up on humanized mice.
So in the lab leak scenario, how would the virus have left the lab?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Well, it would have left, it could very easily have left the lab because of the safety conditions under which Dr. Xi was working. So I should say in her defense, she was following the same international rules for working with coronaviruses as all other virologists do. So lab safety is sort of measured in three levels, depending on the number of sort of safety precautions you have, from one to four. BSL one is the easiest, laxest to work in, and BSL four, that's where you see people in sort of space suits walking around with these bubbles over their heads. So virologists don't really like to work in BSL-4 conditions. It's very sort of cumbersome. Everything takes twice as long. And the rules for working with coronavirus were really, you might think, quite lax. So if you were working with SARS-1 or MERS, which we know, of course, human pandemics, you had to use the third level up, BSL-3. If you were working with just any other coronavirus, whatever manipulations you were doing to it, you could work in BSL-2. So BSL-2 just means, well, you wear gloves and a coat, and you put up a notice saying biohazard, and you work under hoods. That's about it. It's sort of roughly very effective. It's not completely effective.
And do you have confirmation from the Chinese scientists that that was the safety level they were working under?
Yes, in several ways. Firstly, Dr. Xi describes in her experiments what safety level she was working under, and at least some, maybe much or all of this work was in BSL level 2. And moreover, Dr. Xi herself told Science magazine in an interview that all her work was done in BSL 2 or 3.
So you've mentioned Dr. Xi a few times and Mr. Barak. Have you approached these scientists and put your theories to them? Have you got any response?
No, I haven't. And probably I should have done. Now, Dr. Barak is a signatory of the letter that appeared in Science this week calling for an investigation to the lab escape theory. So he certainly believes that lab escape is possible and should be investigated. Dr. Xi is generally rather hard to reach.
So she did submit to a question and answer interview with Science magazine, didn't she, where she gave quite legalistic but extended answers to some of those questions that you pose. And for example, she was very clear that SARS-CoV-2, they had done a genomic sequence of it, which they themselves submitted to the World Health Organization in early January of last year. They were sure at that moment that they had not come in contact with it before. They had not done any experiments with it before in the lab. And she even goes so far as to say she has not done any of these synthesized virus experiments on viruses which have not been detailed and recorded. So she's quite comprehensive in saying this is not true. What's your reaction to those statements?
Well, I think you have to understand her statements against the background that the Chinese authorities are controlling very carefully all information that comes out. So basically, they've put a seal on all information, all the Wuhan Institute of Virology's records are sealed, all Dr. Xi's experiments are sealed, what virus she was working on. All Chinese databases concerning bat viruses have been made inaccessible. So you could say, well, this is the way authoritarian regimes behave anyway. But I think there's a sort of pattern to what the Chinese authorities are doing. And this means because they're locking down all information in general, I think it's not illogical to assume that all the information they do let out is released for a purpose. And that overall purpose is to deny that lab escape happened and to point people toward natural emergence. So I think, Dr. Xi is in a sort of terrible position, and I hesitate to say she's lying, but I think everyone can see that she's probably not absolutely free in what she says. It has to conform to the narrative the Chinese authorities are trying to project.
So if, Nicholas, obviously this is a big if, and as you say, there isn't conclusive evidence for either of these theories at the moment, they are just conjecture. But if it is true, what would that then mean? That would mean some sort of cover-up within the Chinese administration. Would that mean a cover-up even beyond China's borders, do you think?
Yes and no. I mean, to your first question, yes, the Chinese authorities are clearly covering up evidence. They refuse to let the WHO commission see anything of value. So in the sort of plainest sense of the term, they are covering up whatever it is they want to remain concealed. Now, I don't think anyone else is taking positive steps to cover things up. It's just that virologists themselves all around the world are not sort of particularly keen on the idea that their technology is at the root of a really terrible pandemic. So very naturally, they're not inclined to think that the virus could have escaped from a lab. And when these two very influential letters came out in early last year, the Lancet one that you mentioned and another in Nature Medicine, this was just a sort of handful of people, authors of them. No other virologist stepped forward to dispute that. No virologist said, well, we should certainly consider lab escape since this is a logical possibility. And to do so would have been very dangerous for them because, unfortunately on academic campuses, for all kinds of reasons, we don't have free speech anymore. And for virologists, they depend for their careers on being awarded grants by other virologists. So the way grants are distributed both in the US and the UK basically is you have a peer review, committees of expert virologists who review the grant applications from other virologists. So if you step out of line and if you say, well, I think this virus may have escaped from the lab, good luck on getting your grant renewed at the next review period. So that is the reason why virologists have been so silent.
I guess that's not the whole reason though, is it? So in a part, as you say, there's a kind of professional loyalty or slash keenness to remove from the scenario uncomfortable questions that might prove awkward or embarrassing. Then there's this other question, which is politics, because Donald Trump famously was quite keen on the lab leak thesis. He said so much that out there, he said that he believes it to be true quite a few times. And so suddenly it became a kind of Donald Trump conspiracy theory to ask those questions, and it became the sensible person's, scientific consensus view to steer away from those questions. Is that fair, do you think?
Yes, that's exactly correct. I mean, it's extremely unfortunate that the issues become politicized, and it's so ridiculous because politics has absolutely nothing useful to contribute to this issue. It's a scientific issue and should be seen as such. But you're right, as soon as Trump said that, that politicized it. So if you're on the left, you're against lab escape. And if you're on the right, you're more open to it. I'm sure the way that started was that if you look at what the intelligence services in the US have said, both during the Trump administration and during the Biden administration, they have said very simply that lab escape cannot be ruled out. They've been very consistent. So I'm sure that's what they said to Trump, lab escape cannot be ruled out. He then twisted that into saying, well, it definitely came from the Wuhan lab. I think that's how it all started, and it's very regrettable.
It's now changing somewhat. Do you notice that? It feels like in the last couple of weeks, some senior, credible scientists have been coming on board with wanting to investigate this theory more. Do you feel like the tide is turning in favor of a lab leak hypothesis?
Yes, I do. And the letter in Science from the 18 scientists I think that will start to change things a lot. I think it's gradually dawning on people that the WHO commission came back empty-handed with respect to the natural emergence hypothesis. So they're beginning to see there's no evidence there. And however plausible that may have been to begin with, it's increasingly less plausible month by month. So that I think, is contributing to a turn of opinion, though it's still highly polarized. I've been very disappointed that the left has paid no attention to my article, whereas I keep getting requests from the right. I would much prefer that all sides were interested.
There's one piece of evidence that we haven't talked about, which is what you refer to as the nearest thing to a smoking gun in favor of the lab leak hypothesis. And it's quite technical, but I think we should try and go into it to share it with our viewers. This is to do with the evidence in the genes of the virus itself that seem to suggest human engineering as opposed to natural evolution. What is it?
Well, in the middle of the gene for the spike protein, there's a little insert called the furin cleavage site. And it's very important for the virus when it attacks a human cell with one part of its spike protein. The other part then has to help the virus merge with the membrane of the human cell. But the other part can't do that unless the junction between the two halves of spike is cut. So there's a natural protein on the surface of human cells called furin, which has a quite different purpose. But it will cut any protein it sees that has a particular sequence of amino acids. And the genetic sequence that specifies these amino acids is present right there between the two parts of SARS-CoV-2 spike protein. So the reason this sort of sticks out like a sore thumb is that no other member of the SARS-CoV-2's coronavirus family has this furin cleavage site. So the way viruses sort of acquire new properties in general is either by mutation, which is very unlikely in this case because so many mutations would be involved, or it's by something called recombination. So that happens when two viruses happen to infect the same cell. And as their nuclear material is duplicated, viruses get assembled accidentally with bits and pieces of the other virus. So this is a way in which sort of properties can be exchanged or among a family of viruses. But what you cannot acquire by recombination is a property that your virus family does not possess. And because no other beta coronavirus of the SARS-CoV-2 family, they're called Sarbeco viruses, has a furin cleavage site. Therefore, you have to consider the possibility that it was inserted in a lab. And in fact, virologists have known for years that the way to soup up a virus and make it really infective is to insert a furin cleavage site.
So is there no way that SARS-CoV-2 could have acquired a furin cleavage site naturally?
Well, you can't be as absolute as that because viruses are always doing unexpected things. I mean, this is sort of evolution's way, sort of billions of variations, and natural selection will pick the one that works that often to our eyes seems sort of very unlikely. So you can't rule out the possibility that somehow the furin cleavage site was acquired naturally, but it's just one of the extra implausibilities that you need to explain on the lab emergence theory. You've got all these other things to explain. Why did it break out at the doorstep of the Wuhan Institute of Virology? Why was it perfectly adapted to human cells right from the start, unlike all other viruses? Why does it have a furin cleavage site? So there are all these improbabilities that you need to explain, and this is just another one.
So is there any evidence that Dr. Shi and her group inside the Wuhan Virology Institute were inserting furin cleavage sites into other viruses to make them more infective with humans?
Well, not specifically, but I believe there's at least one paper in which Dr. Shi has inserted a furin cleavage site. I mean, she and her colleagues certainly knew about this technology. I mean, it's sort of, it's old hat technology. It's widely known. You insert a furin cleavage site if you want to soup up a virus. And she certainly could have done it. We don't know that she did.
So SARS-CoV-2, COVID-19, contains this feature then that is makes it particularly successful at attacking humans, which is something that we know earlier labs and earlier scientists have done in order to try and make a virus more effective. And that, in your mind, is quite a compelling piece of evidence in favor of the idea that it's a lab leak virus.
Yes, it's an important piece of evidence. It's by itself, it's certainly not proof, but it's certainly something that will catch the attention of virologists, and they will recognize that it's something that needs to be explained one way or another.
So having reviewed all of this evidence, Nicholas, you've got your science journalist hat on. What do you think happened?
Well, as I say in the article, there's no direct evidence for either theory, so there's no proof for either theory. But if you take the available evidence and say which theory explains it better, well, on present evidence, in my view, lab escape explains it better. So that's what I think is the more probable outcome based on what we know so far.
Nicholas Wade, thank you so much for talking us through it.
You're very welcome. Thanks for your interest.
Well, there you have it. Thanks to Nicholas Wade for talking us through that. The furin cleavage site, let it never be said that we don't get technical enough on this show, is a feature of a virus that looks like it might, not definitely, but might have been inserted by man in terms of a laboratory instead of being naturally evolved. So evidence there for you to arrive at your own conclusions. Clearly, if it was an escape from the Wuhan Institute of Virology, the implications of that would be enormous. Thanks for watching. This was Lockdown TV.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.